Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Andy Stanley Leadership Podcast, a conversation designed to help leaders go further, faster. I'm Andy Stanley, and I will be your host today. But before we jump into today's content, I wanted to talk about leading remotely, because come on, whether you're just dipping your toes into remote leadership in this season or you've jumped in with both feet, one thing is for certain, while it's not rocket science, it does take some getting used to, right? At least in order to be successful. Thankfully, our partner, Belay, has 10 years of experience being 100%, a 100% remote company, and has the expertise necessary to help guide you through this unprecedented season. So, for our podcast listeners, they are offering a free 4-part mini remote leadership masterclass tailored to get you on this journey and get you to the end of this journey. It covers a variety of topics, including productivity, communication, and culture. And again, this is designed for you to be 100% remote. As a podcast listener, I know you are a learner, which means you have what it takes to lead a thriving, engaged, productive team remotely, and Belay can help. To learn more and to take advantage of this limited time offer, text Andy to 31996. That's Andy to 31996, or visit belaysolutions.com/Andy. Belay Solutions, B-E-L-A-Y, solutions.com/Andy. And now, let's jump into today's podcast content. Today is part two of a 2-part series on decision-making, more specifically decision-making by the numbers, the Enneagram numbers. And back in the studio with me is my friend Ian Cron, the expert on all things Enneagram. Welcome back, Ian.
Thanks, Andy. I'm glad to be here.
As most of you know, especially if you listened to last month's podcast, Ian is a best-selling author, Enneagram teacher, psychotherapist, songwriter, Episcopal priest. His most recent book is The Road Back to You, An Enneagram Journey to Self-Discovery, which I, as I mentioned last month, Ian, I have read the book twice, and it has become a go-to resource for me as it relates to staff management and understanding my own family. And as we talked about last month, understanding myself, especially as it relates, as we're going to see, the decision-making. So again, I'm so excited to have you back. Now, if you did not hear part one of this conversation, I highly recommend that you pause and maybe go back and listen to the first episode, because we are going to build on that conversation. Or of course, if you prefer, you can go back and listen to part one later. So Ian, let's catch our audience up on the topic of the Enneagram and decision-making and why this is so important to understand.
Right. So the last time we were together, we discussed how each of the 9 Enneagram personality types approaches making decisions.
Yep.
And it's been a fascinating exercise for me. You know, the Enneagram is an ancient personality typing system, teaches there are 9 basic personality styles in the world. And one of the things it teaches you is that everybody sees the world through a different lens. And I tell leaders all the time, one of the most egregious mistakes they can make is to presume that their way of seeing the world is normal. Hmm. Because if you believe that, that means when you meet people who see the world differently than you do, you will judge them, right? As either abnormal or incompetent, right?
Yeah. And I remember last time we were together, I think your statement was there are 9 normals.
That's right.
And I've remembered that.
That's
because
right.
It's, again, it's difficult not to assume that my normal is the normal.
That's right. So I think our topic today is really going to be fun, and I've loved thinking about it and getting ready for it.
Well, today we're going to continue on the theme of decision-making, but this time around we're going to talk about how other people's decisions impact us, or not so much impact us, how we process decisions that are made that impact us as it relates to our Enneagram number. And as fascinating as last month's podcast conversation was, this one is really interesting because we all know we have a pattern when it comes to responding to other people, but specifically responding to decisions other people make that impact us. Mm-hmm. And where I think today's conversation is going to be so helpful is not simply understanding how we respond, but being reminded, as you just said, that our decisions that impact other people impact them potentially 9 different ways. So let's jump in.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's have at it. Just by way of framing this, you know, whenever we talk about different Enneagram types or personalities, we're talking about probabilities, right? I can't predict with complete certainty how an Enneagram type will respond when others make decisions that affect them. But based on my experience, I think I can tell you how I think, how they probably will respond. But people surprise us all the time, right? So there's a disclaimer to get us going to, for clarity's sake. So type one, the improvers, right? I think in general, improvers will support a decision that affects them if certain criteria are met, okay? Three of them. I'd say one is they trust the person making the decision has integrity. The second one would be that the rationale and the process behind the decision is clearly explained. And then thirdly, if they believe the decision is the ethical and responsible thing to do and it's for the greater good. And I think those are the criteria that will inspire a one to comply or be okay with a decision someone else has made that affects them.
As a one, I would wholeheartedly agree with that. I do not, even as a leader, I don't feel compelled to make all the decisions. But that is how I process a decision that in some way informs something I have to do. If I have to publicly acknowledge or support a decision, if there's anything slightly unethical, that is such a red flag for me. Not because I always do everything, not because I'm perfect, but in terms of agreeing to somebody else's decision, the ethical part or the ethical component of a decision or the ethical ramifications of a decision are a huge deal for me.
Yeah. Most ones will protest a decision that affects them if they discover the person making it bent or broke the rules to do it, if established procedures and protocols weren't followed about the decision being made, or if they perceive the decision is unfair and was made for the sake of expediency.
Yep.
You want to talk about type twos?
Let's talk
about those helpers. Warm, caring, supportive, generous. They're going to support decisions that genuinely help or meet the needs of others, even if backing it requires the helper to make personal sacrifices. A helper is going to struggle to go along with a decision if it was made without taking their feelings and the feelings of others into consideration, or if it threatens relationships between people.
So the one is fine if it's the right thing to do. The two is fine as long as we take into consideration not simply that it's the right thing to do, but how is this going to make other people feel? Not just how is it going to affect how it's going to affect them. It's have we taken into consideration how they're going to feel about it?
Yes, exactly.
Because as a one, that's not my primary go-to.
No.
So this is helpful.
Yeah. Again, just learning difference and having appreciation for difference. Because one of the things you need in the room when you're making a decision is a two that can say, hey, Andy, I understand your decision. Now, how are we going to bake into our calculations how people will feel about it?
Which has a lot to do with how we communicate the decision.
Yes. And by the way, no one is better at enlisting other people's, getting other people to buy into a decision than a two.
Because
they're so interpersonal. They're so socially adept and persuasive. And their enthusiasm's contagious. So
if you win the twos over, you've just created a raving fan about a decision that once they move into the organization as a fan of the decision, that's a win for a leader.
They're a walking advertisement for the wisdom of the decision.
Wow. So again, not to stay on this for too long, but as a one, I'm learning as we have this discussion. So it would be important for me, even if I'm genuinely concerned about how a decision impacts someone else, it would be important for me to make sure the twos understand that I've thought that through, that I've taken that into consideration, that I listen to the feedback they may have about how it impacts people that I may have missed, and at least acknowledge we've taken that into consideration.
Yes.
That's for a two, that's probably all they need to get on board with the right decision.
Right.
To know that people have at least taken that into consideration, I would guess.
Yes. And it'd be very wise for you with twos, as the decision is implemented and goes forward, that you at every opportunity express appreciation to them for supporting the decision and getting out there and representing the decision in a positive light.
Wow. So threes, how do threes respond to decisions that impact them?
Yeah, well, so unlike improvers, right? Threes, the performers, are more guided by practical considerations than by ideals. They want to be perceived as successful and avoid failure at all costs, okay? So they're going to be guided by practical considerations more, you know, they're going to be more concerned about those than by ideals. You're going to be more concerned about ideals, okay? So when others make decisions that affect them, a results-focused performer is going to ask the question, will this decision clear a path to the quickest, most efficient way of achieving the goal? Hmm. And if it is, they're on board. If not, they're frustrated.
Hmm. So it's about, again, the finish line, as we talked about last month.
Yes.
And the fours?
They're tricky, man. They are.
And just to remind our audience, Ian is a four, so he knows what he's talking
about. Yeah. So when others make decisions that affect them, an individualist is going to ask, will agreeing or supporting this decision require me to compromise my values? So let me give you an example of this. I worked with a company. They had a four designer, a brilliant designer, did all of their brochures. And they did high-end kind of stuff, mailed brochures, right? And they worked incredibly hard on it, brought it to the person in charge, and they discovered that it was going to cost about $50 per, you know,
brochure.
Oh, wow. Because it was so beautifully done, right? And that four wouldn't compromise. Mm. You know, they said you got to go cheaper. You got to do this. They're like, nope.
It's got to be the expensive paper. It's got to be four color.
Yep. You're asking me to compromise my values. So I would just say that it's going to be related to values for fours. And if it requires them to compromise values, then they're not going to go along with a decision that's being, you know.
Yeah. So what do you do in that situation? Because we love graphic designers. We love the artists. Again, it's very personal. It's an expression of their soul. And now we want to shorten it and, you know, can we cut the verse and we don't really like that word and it can't be that big and we don't like yellow and, you know, all of that feels, that's so heavy to them.
So you're in a meeting with a four. They raise their hand and they offer a suggestion about something that you should do. As long as you recognize them in the moment by saying something like, you know, Bob or Jane, thank you for what you always bring to the table, which is a creative angle on how we might do things, but we're going to go in this direction. They'll be completely fine with it. Hmm. But if you don't recognize it, right, then you'll have a resentful four on your hands.
But how do you approach the four who has presented their idea? And again, it's an expression of what's on the inside of them, and we can't do it or we can't do it that way, or by the time we finish with their idea, they're not going to be as proud of it. Or I've been in meetings where I could tell, or actually the actual response was, just don't associate my name with it.
Right.
Because what I've presented you, I'll sign. But by the time you print it or record it or present it,
right,
it's so different than what I brought in here. I'm not sure. It is so personal. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, I do.
So what's the win?
You know,
as a four, I'm asking you as a four.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, I think for me, I have a very strong three wing. So I like to get a job done and I'm willing to compromise. I'm almost 60 years old. I've learned, you know, as a younger man, I wouldn't compromise. You know, when I was a songwriter, I would not compromise.
Right.
Now I've learned that to be more of a critical thinker, not just a feeler, realizing that at times, to get things done and out the door, you got to make compromises. Yep. But with a young four, it's very hard.
And this goes back to something we talked about last month. Again, if you did not listen to last month's podcast, please go back and listen. We talked about self-awareness.
Yes.
That the common denominator of some of the most successful people in the world, successful leaders, is not their Enneagram number, it's self-awareness.
Right.
And so what you just described is self-awareness that comes with time and with age and with experience. And there, you just don't die on every hill over every verse and color and size and how thick the paper is.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah. And just like, guess what? Live with your disappointment.
Yeah.
You know, that's just how it goes.
Welcome to life, right?
Yeah, welcome to life, you know? I mean, as a leader, you know, sometimes you have to make hard decisions. They disappoint people. You do your best to support them in the disappointment. But if they don't receive it, that's on them.
Yep. Quick story. You may not know this about me. I wrote a lot of music too when I was younger. And a friend of mine, Donna Douglas, and I wrote a couple of musicals, youth musicals for churches for students when I was much younger. And I was invited to a church to see them perform this musical that I wrote with Donna. And it was, there were some drama pieces and acting and, you know, a set, and it was horrible. Not the musical, the performance of the musical. And I knew at the end, the leader of this church was going to have me stand up and introduce, oh, and we're so glad to have Andy Stanley. He's here. And he actually wrote the music and wrote the script for the, and I knew that was coming at the end. And I was so embarrassed by the performance of what I had seen done, because we'd done it at our church and I'd seen some extraordinary expressions of what I thought was this great music and this great story. It took everything in me not to leave. I'm serious. Not to leave before it was over so that I wasn't introduced and associated with this horrible presentation. So I don't know. That I don't have much for in me, but there was a, you know, if you're not going to do it the way I wrote it or created it, then please don't associate me with it. So anyway, moving on.
Moving on.
So when Fives have decisions made that impact them, how do Fives respond?
You know, I think when others make decisions that affect Fives, they're going to say, let me see the facts. Let me see the data.
Or did you look at the data?
Right. And if they sense that you did and your case is clear, they'll get behind you. What they won't get behind you for is if they feel like you made this decision based on emotions or on an intuition. And, you know, Fives overprivilege intellect, actually. They need a little bit more intuition. You know what I'm saying? A little bit more feeling. But really, when it comes down to it, the number one thing that's going to matter to them is data and the facts.
So it's, hey, I looked at what you gave me. I appreciate the data. I took this into consideration. I read the report, whatever it might be. We're going in a different direction, but thank you. And please continue to provide me with this kind of information. Just because it didn't go your way this time, I don't want that to discourage you from continuing to provide this kind of objective data, sort of a response.
You know, I'm a 4, very feeling-based person. One of my best friends is a 5. Every time I have to make a decision that requires a non-emotional, objective viewpoint, I call him, I give him the information. I said, I got too many feelings. I need you.
I'm too close to this.
I got too many feelings. I need you to go through in your own mind what you think I should do based on the facts. And inevitably, he gives me great counsel, and probably 90% of the time I follow it. I mean, that's the beauty of the Enneagram, right?
Yep.
Is you got these 9 normals. I know that my normal does not include that gift.
Yep.
You know?
Well, again, it's self-awareness. It's why this is such a valuable tool, again, in understanding our kids, our spouses, and, you know, the dynamics at work. Before we continue, as I mentioned at the top of the broadcast, our sponsor Belay is offering our listeners a free 4-part mini remote leadership masterclass. So if you're ready to lead a thriving, engaged, and productive team remotely, just text Andy to 31996. That's Andy to 31996. So moving on, the 6s, how do 6s respond when a decision impacts them?
Yeah, these are the loyalists, right? When others make decisions that affect them, 6s will initially be anxious and possibly suspicious that there are ulterior motives at play, right? The 6s usually have issues around authority figures, right? And, you know, does this person have a hidden agenda? Can I trust them? Now, once you've won their trust, they're with you for life, like nobody's business. But at first, they're a little hesitant to buy in, right? So they're going to ask you a lot of questions as a leader, right? And don't misinterpret that as disloyalty, okay? What's going on there is they want to know if you have thought through the big picture and you have seen all the potential problems and you have a contingency plan in place should those problems arise, you know?
Because they're fear-based, right?
They're fear-based and... They just want to know, they're fear-based about what could go wrong.
Right.
they'll look at any plan.
Because
they're the
they've
first
already
person.
Run down all those paths in their mind anyway.
You bet.
They just want to make sure you've at least at least glanced down some of those paths.
Yep.
Right?
So, so here's what a friend of mine who was a pastor used to do. If he was announcing, let's say, a building campaign, he'd have an all-church meeting. And then he'd have a second all-church meeting to cover the same material. Because if we think there are more sixes in the population than any other type. So he knew that the sixes in the room, they tend to, you know, they'll listen to the information, chorus of voices. They're not the first one to raise their hand and ask a question. So he has the second meeting for the sixes who've had time to think about it, then to raise their hands. Because he knows if he doesn't have the sixes on board, this thing's not going forward.
Wow. Now, another application of that, I've never associated that with Enneagram numbers, but I've learned through the years, one of the best ways to end a phone call is to say to someone, hey, if you think of something later on that you wish you had asked me, or if you think of something later on that you forgot to say, this, you've got my cell number, text me, call me, because that happens. People are like, oh, they either didn't have the nerve to say it, they felt like I was rushed, or they didn't think of, as soon as they get off, we've all done that. You get off the phone, you think, oh, I should have asked. So I always try to end those, especially a conversation that's a difficult conversation,
right,
to say, if you know, if you think of something later, just call me. And at the six, I guess, is the one that most likely going
to
call me
music
back
to the ears, because they're going to need to think.
Yeah, right?
So here's the deal with sixes. They tend to self-question. Okay, so they're going to be going over the information they heard in their head. They need a lot of time to sort of process it. And they're going to ask you those questions. And what you want to do is answer all of them. Because if you don't, and you end the conversation by going, oh, you're such a pessimist, you know, they're going to say, no, I'm not. I'm a realist. You know, and once that you exhaust their questions, they will, sometimes they're called the troopers. Because once they're behind you,
they'll sign on. Yeah.
You know, when they say I do, it's forever.
And again, this goes back to something we've talked about before, but bears repeating. It's so important for those of us in leadership not to confuse someone who's asking a question with being questioned.
Right.
And it's so easy for that switch to flip in my mind. Oh, you're not simply asking a question, you're questioning me. And it is, there is never a win in responding as if you are being questioned. I've learned even when you know you're being questioned, it's still better to respond and assume the best on the questioner, even if it's a gotcha question, to just play along like you're dumb, like, oh, well, that's a great question. But for the six, if I communicate I'm being questioned, I've lost them.
Right.
Because now I'm suspect and they're already suspect to begin with. So that's great. Okay, what about sevens? How do sevens respond when?
Oh, boy, they're tricky. Now, you know this as a dad of a seven. I have a seven as well. They'll resist any decision that imposes too many limitations or restrictions on them. Any decision that closes down options, escape plans, you know. They're going to ask themselves, does the decision leave me any wiggle room, you know, to take my own course, you know?
This is how my seven growing up responded constantly. Do I have to?
Yes.
Do I have to? Do I have to? And finally, we laugh about this. He's 27 now, or 26. And so I finally shut it down when he was old enough to understand this response. I said, Garrett, you don't have to, but you need to understand, now that you're this tall, no one can make you do anything for the rest of your life. They can only keep you from doing things. And prisons are for people where we keep them from doing things because you can't make an adult do anything. So no, you don't have to. And he looked at me, and I don't think he ever asked me that again. Now, I'm not suggesting that this is a parenting principle. I'm just sharing a story.
Yeah.
But it's the seven. It's like, okay, wait. You just put me in a box.
Right.
So are there, tell me the options, tell me the options. So it's, you know, do I have to? So anyway.
Yeah, and they're definitely not going to follow a decision that's going to cause them to experience too many distressing psychological or emotional
things. Life is about having fun. Yeah.
Yeah. They have a half range of emotions, really, you know, fun to ecstasy. But everything after that, like grief, sadness, you know, it's not, when I mean negative feelings, for like a seven, stuck, boredom, those are feelings that are intolerable yep. if they go too long, right? So if a decision is made and it's going to lead to some of those things, they can see it coming, they're not going to be real happy
That's
about
so it. That's so important. And again, going back to my seven at home, Garrett is our most fun person.
Yes. Yes.
And he has helped me. I tell him this now that he's an adult. He helps me think in terms of experiences that are enjoyable rather than just work all the time. It really has kind of pulled me out of some of the ruts that I can get into so easily as a one where everything has to be moving forward and, you know,
right.
perfect. And but again, to those of you who are parents, this is why you need to read this book while your kids are still living at home. And Sandra and I have said to him, we would have been a much better parent to you as a seven because we're both ones.
Right.
So we just want to make things better.
Right.
And that is fun to us. Fun is we made something better.
Right.
And he's like, what are we going to do next? You know,
yeah.
So I would have been a much better parent to my seven if I had had this book way back then.
Do you want to hear one of my worst parenting moments with a seven?
Absolutely. Make me feel better.
We are in Greenwich, Connecticut. It's New Year's Eve. We lived there for a number of years, but we've been gone now for quite some time. So we have no friends, no parties, nothing to do. So I say to my seven son, Aiden, hey, you want to go to the movies tonight? He's like, yeah, let's go to the movies, you know? And he said, you pick one, okay? And I said, great. So what movie do you think I took him to see on New Year's Eve? Manchester by the Sea. If you know anything about—
Now, how old was he?
I was 15.
Okay.
I want you to tell you, it is probably one of the most depressing films known to humankind, okay? Now, I, as a four, am like—
Oh, you felt it.
Oh.
Yeah.
It was beautifully done, well acted. I mean, everything about the ending was so authentic, right? Meanwhile, he's next to me, like, you know, like needing a drip bag of antidepressants. Do you know what I'm saying? And he looks at me, he goes, I need a streamer, a balloon, anything, get me out of this theater. So that was a moment where I lacked enough self-awareness. I probably should have taken him to see, you know, something a little bit lighter than Manchester by the Sea. Bad moment.
But you were taking him to a movie.
Yeah, you got a movie.
You picked a four movie. You didn't pick a seven movie.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know, next time. Eights.
Eights.
Love them.
How
challenges.
Do eights respond? And this is important because, as I mentioned last time, my podcast producer, who is over all of our broadcasts, actually is an eight, and she's sitting here listening to us. So,
yep.
How is she impacted when I make a decision that impacts her?
So, understand something first about eights. They hate anyone telling them what to do. So,
she has a mask on, so I can't see her expression.
Yeah, well,
but I think she smiles.
In general, they don't like it when people tell them what to do.
Yep.
And here's another interesting thing about them. They are controlling of environments and other people, but there's one thing they hate more than anything else, which is when others try to control them, okay? So if you want an eight to do something, just tell them not to do it, and they'll do it. You know what I'm saying? Like, they have that streak to them, right? So they're going to resist or fight back when anyone tries to control them, right?
So when a decision is made that they're not a part of, and they're informed, oh, this decision has been made, therefore you have to or you can't, they're
right.
going to
resist. Yeah, if not, fight back, okay? Now, they're going to comply with the decision that affects them so long as the decision maker, the person in charge, is strong, decisive, knows where they're heading, tells the truth, nothing but the truth, the whole truth, even if the truth is horrible news, keeps the lines of communication open, and does not divert from the plan. They need a strong leader. If they have that, the decision maker leader, they will follow you off a cliff.
And when you say divert from the plan, okay, here's the decision, here's what you need to do. They don't necessarily like it, but if I'm going to ask them to do something they don't necessarily like, I better stick with what I've asked them to do and not start changing it along the way. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, no, I'm saying the overall plan, okay? You have an overall plan. They're not going to like it if you start waffling.
I got you.
If you start self-doubting, if you start self-questioning,
right.
The eight's going to like throw their hands up in the air and go, what, you want to change the plan now? We should stick to the plan, right? So you're smiling right now as I say that. Is that because
Well, I work with several eights, and That is so true.
Yeah.
And it is on me. And here's how I try to remember to end all of my, really all of my meetings now, but I've learned this from working with eights. Today, I had a directional team meeting with five staff, and I try to remember to do this every time. Is there anything you need from me? This is the last, this is the end of the meeting. Before we've done all the agenda, are there any questions I need to answer for you so that you can continue doing what you're doing? Is there anything you need from me? Because I've learned with eights, they're further down the road than I am in so many cases. But because I'm the boss, I can be an impediment to their progress. Well, their progress is my progress. Right. We're all making progress together. So if I don't answer the questions quick enough, or if I, again, in my oneness where I'm trying to make the perfect answer, or, you know, I need more time to think about it, that is very frustrating to an eight. And I don't want the eights to be frustrated because they, you know, they're kind of the rocket ships. I mean, they're the jet fuel. They're the get things done.
And momentum.
So, yeah.
It's all about forward momentum, yeah. Right?
And like eights, I love progress as well. I want to make things better. So
the difference is that an eight will at times not take the time to think through or consider everything that could happen as a result of their action. You will think a lot longer about those types of things down the road, right? But man, nose and tackle, you want some eights around you, babe.
And those of you who are listening in leadership roles, you either are an eight or you work with eights. There's, when you read the book or as you become more and more familiar with Enneagram, you're gonna recognize, especially if you are in upper level management in any capacity, they're to your left or to your right, because that's where eights generally end up if they're healthy enough to maintain, you know, relational integrity along the way. And working with or managing an eight is an art. And, you know, I love the eights. But again, a self-aware, mature eight, it's a pleasure to work with them.
Oh,
they make everything better. And because there's so much forward progress and forward motion, they pull things along with them.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, and of course, I said all that because Susie's sitting here. She's still smiling. So anyway.
Behind the mask.
Behind the mask. All right. So nines, how do nines respond when decisions are made that impact them?
Yeah. So, you know, nines and sixes both struggle with making decisions themselves. It's really hard on them. When others make decisions that affect them, a nine's going to be tempted to merge with the group's opinion of the decision. So if the group says, we think this is a great decision, the nine will be, yeah, that's a great decision.
Yep.
And if the group says, we don't like this decision, the nine will say, yeah, I don't like the decision either, right? So one of the growth or transformational paths for nines is learning to individuate, find their own voice, assert it, name it, you know, in whatever context they're in, and follow what their gut tells them, you know?
Not this is something they have to be reminded to do, you're saying?
Oh, absolutely.
Because this isn't intuitive for
because they avoid conflict, right? So they don't want to be the one person in the room who says, I don't agree with the rest of you. I think this is a good decision or a bad decision, whatever the case may be. That is not what a nine is going to want to do.
They're not the contrarian.
They are not the contrarian at all. The six could be a contrarian, right? A one could be a contrarian. An eight for sure could be a contrarian. These are more aggressive numbers, right? You know, nines want to keep the peace both internally and externally. So, you know, they're going to want to be tempted to just go along, to get along, because everybody else's opinions feel stronger to them than their own, right? So they'll be like, well, geez, if everybody feels that strongly about it, I'll just roll with it.
So here's what I've learned about nines. They're quiet in meetings, and I have to draw them out.
Yes.
I have to call them out by name and say, you know, what do you think? Because they will sit through a discussion and say nothing. And I know they have an opinion and they're smart. That's why they're at the table. But I generally, for the nines, I have to draw them out into the conversation. Is that
common? Yeah, and sometimes,
common?
Yes, it's so common. And it's so wise of you to do that because so often—
I won't know what they're thinking otherwise.
Well, there's that, and they also have a lot of wisdom because they have this supernatural ability to see things from everybody's perspective, okay? They just are amazing at that, right? Seeing the world through everybody else's eyes, okay? And so they often see the big picture. Like, for example, you have laser-focused attention, right? the attention of a nine is diffuse, right? So it's taking in the whole, right? You could become so focused that you miss a lot of stuff going on around
you.
Right? Mm-hmm. But the nine is picking it all up, right? And so sometimes they're going to have wisdom that you really need, mm-hmm. right? Now, what I might do in that situation is say, well, tell me what you're thinking, Sarah. And then Sarah will say something and I'll go, now, Sarah, I'm going to ask the question again just to give you another opportunity. What are you really thinking about this? Mm. Because their first temptation might be, they're looking around the group, don't want to have conflict, you know, they're feeling a little cornered, you know, like a raccoon in the garage, you know, and they're just a little spooked, right? And then just gently say, great, I really value your opinion. Is that all you want to say? Because I really welcome you to
yep.
be full-throated about your thoughts on this topic.
Is it correct to say that an unhealthy nine is most inclined to be passive aggressive because
yes.
they're unable or unwilling to break with that kind of internal drive not to create problems, but now I've made a decision that's going to negatively impact, or it's going to be a hassle, or it's not going to be what they want to do, but they're not necessarily going to push back like an eight. You can read an eight's body language.
Yes.
Oh, you know, you don't have to finish the sentence. It's like, I sense some resistance, but the nine, again, if I don't draw it out,
yep.
but then they're going to leave the room or leave the decision. And I've seen, passive aggressive tendencies with
totally.
Nines.
Yeah. So when they're not very healthy, here's what, this is another one of their crazy superpowers. They can look at you like they agree with you and you'll be convinced they agree with you, but they will never have said it, right? But there's just something that makes you feel like they're agreeing with you when inside they're thinking, no way, Jose, right?
Hmm.
And the way that passive aggressiveness gets expressed is through stubbornness. It's kind of, you'll be feeling like as the plan goes along, you're marching downfield, that someone's got their hand on the emergency brake and they keep
yep.
pulling up
yep.
on it and they're slowing down
right.
or whatever. So their anger, an eight's anger externalizes. Mm-hmm. As you know, a one's anger goes inward at yourself, that self-critical
yep.
spirit, right?
Yep.
For the nine, they'll go, what anger? I've never been angry in my life, right? They're unaware of their own anger. And so it comes out sideways.
Mm. Oh, wow.
Right.
It
leaks
that passive aggressive.
Sideways.
Yeah.
So you want to make sure, for example, if you have made a decision, right, and you relay it to the nine, you want to get a verbal answer from them that they are with it or not. You don't want to just say, oh, they look like they agreed.
Yeah. They nodded.
They nod. Mm. Maybe. It's just even in the eyes. They're just kind of looking at you. And because they didn't say no, you assumed yes. With nines all the time, I'm saying, now listen, this is the plan. I need to hear a verbal yes or no that you are or not on the board. Now, my wife's a nine, and we've had this conversation before, you know, like,
yep.
I need a verbal.
You know, going back to last month, we talked about the decision that we made to suspend our worship services for several months. And when we made the decision, again, there were about 12 people in the room. And I remember now that we're having this conversation, I want to know what everybody thought. And I could see we had about 5 people on a Zoom call on a big screen, and then the rest were in the room. And I could sense all of this. And I remember now, I actually called on the nine and said by name, what do you think? I knew I needed to hear a voice connect. A head nod wasn't enough because this was a big decision.
Yeah.
And yeah, this person was for it. But I remember intuitively, you know, I want to make sure.
And if you can tell them it's because, see, a nine grows up and the message they hear is your presence and voice don't matter.
Hmm.
They feel less important than other people. And other people's opinions just feel so much stronger to them than their own. So if you call them out and say, I really value what you have to say. In other words, your presence really matters here. Your voice matters. What do you think? And I think you're always surprised that they have wisdom that no other number
Absolutely.
has.
Absolutely. If they're sitting at your leadership team table, they're there for a reason. They've accomplished
yep.
something. They're a value add. And not to get 100% of the value that they add is a loss for the team and the organization.
Absolutely.
Wow. Well, this has been so helpful, Ian. As we wrap up, What's our assignment? What's one step a leader can take, especially those who are just becoming familiar with Enneagram or they've heard their kids talk about it and suddenly it's like, oh, there's some practical value to this. How? What's a next step?
Okay, so a couple of things. One is I do strongly recommend my own book. I know that sounds like I'm being, you know, crazy self-marketing, but it is a great introduction to the Enneagram. Yep. Very accessible. Thanks for all your kind words about it. Secondly, I have a test called the IEQ-9 assessment. You've taken it.
Yep.
It delivers a 44-page report. It'll identify your type, tell you all about it, right? I think it's the best that there is out there. You can go to my website, ianmorgancron.com, and just hit the tab. And for Andy Stanley podcast listeners, if they put North Point 2020, right, into the code box or whatever it is, right, they'll get a 15% discount on it.
Yeah, my daughter convinced me to take the IEQ-9 because, she was convinced I was a 5. You said I was a 1, and she thought after I took the test that she would be proved correct. And as it turned out, you were correct, but of course you were. Anyway, any closing remarks before we wrap this up?
Yeah, you know, I can't emphasize enough, and I think this has been revealed in this conversation in last month's, just how important self-awareness and self-knowledge are, right? People who don't know themselves, let's be honest, they tend to do dumb things, you know? They take the wrong job, follow the wrong career path, they marry the wrong people, you know, the list goes on and on and on. So the more knowledge you have about yourself, the better you are, right? And I want people to know that, because you've been mentioning my book, I want to mention your new book, which I think is a very powerful book that will enhance and elevate people's self-awareness and self-knowledge. Better decisions, fewer regrets, right? I think most people have no idea about the filter or the grid through which they make decisions, you know? And there were a couple of moments as I read that book that stopped me in my tracks. I mentioned one last month when you said, pay attention to the tension. And even in the time that we've had since last being together, that thing has really stuck with me because I have some stuff in my life where, as I told you a while back, you know, gosh, I have not been paying attention to that. And so I thank you and encourage and commend that book to everybody.
Wow. Well, Ian got the advanced reader copy. It comes out in October, Better Decisions, Fewer Regrets. And it is 5 questions I think everybody should ask every time they make a big decision. And these 5 questions enable us to gain some insight into ourselves.
Right.
Because, again, you can't have enough information when it comes to making good decisions, but we tend to rush, especially those personal decisions. So thanks for saying that. Well, Ian, this has been so much fun and so helpful, but we are out of time. So to all of our podcast listeners, thank you for joining us. And I invite you to go to andystanley.com, where you can download the Leadership Podcast application guide that goes with this episode. And it includes a summary of our discussion, and it includes questions for reflection for you as an individual or for your entire team. And in addition, this month's application guide includes a special offer for our listeners on my new book, Better Decisions, Fewer Regrets. Again, thanks for joining us, and we will see you next time on the Andy Stanley Leadership Podcast.